You are very welcome to the Health and Fitness Show. I'm your host, Dr. Diane Cooper, and today we'll be speaking with Laura O'Philbin. She's the Research and Policy Manager at the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland about a report they've just published on young onset dementia. We'll also be speaking with Dr. Ciara Ward, sports scientist, exercise physiologist and health researcher with EduFit, about her very interesting physical inactivity work with the European Space Agency. And of course, finally then, we'll be chatting with Ruth about her tip of the week and recipe of the week, and this will be in line with avoiding food waste. So I'm delighted to be joined on the phone now by Laura O'Philbin. And Laura is the Research and Policy Manager at the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland. Laura, it's lovely to have you with me this evening. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Hi, Diane. Good evening. Thanks so much for having me on.
And, you know, many of our listeners may know, Laura, that actually last month and on the 21st was World Alzheimer's Day. And it was around that time that you published or that a report was published that I thought was really, really interesting. And it's actually about young onset dementia and Alzheimer's.
Yeah, absolutely. So we launched a report there on the 21st of September, as you said, on World Alzheimer's Day. And it's basically about how do you make community groups and service providers, you know, whether it's in healthcare or another service, more open and accessible to people who are affected by younger onset dementia?
Yeah, and actually, do you mind if I ask you, Laura, why are you so interested in this space?
Yeah, I suppose for a long time, people with younger onset dementia have been highlighting how important it is for them to be able to stay involved in their local communities, because younger onset dementia is when a person is diagnosed under the age of 65. Mm. So these could be people in their 40s and their 50s and their early 60s. And they might still have like their work life, financial commitments, a mortgage in a younger family. And usually those people are still very involved in their communities. So they're here receiving a life-changing diagnosis. But a lot of dementia-specific services are actually tailored towards older people. So those who are impacted by younger onset dementia might feel uncomfortable or unsupported in those kind of services that are more for older people. So that's what we're trying to do, is make those communities more open to the younger people affected by dementia.
Sure. Like, so many, including myself, but many of our listeners will be affected by this. So, you know, my lovely, lovely little granny, she had dementia in her later years. And now she took it all very well. She was just really funny. She was always in great humour, and she kind of just embraced the funniness of she just couldn't remember, you know. And luckily she knew who we were for, you know, for those latter years. But so I've seen it, and I've had that experience of it in an older person. And I also spent a year, oh God, about 20 years ago, working in nursing homes as well, where you have a lot of people who have, you know, Alzheimer's dementia. And but also I have seen a younger uncle in his 40s, you know, go through this as well. And what you're talking about there, it's a very different thing to see an older. It's equally as difficult, always difficult for the person and for the families who love them. Of course it is. But the difference, I couldn't even imagine getting that diagnosis for myself as a young person. So to see at least the, you know, these efforts being made to try and help in any way possible, I think is brilliant.
Oh, completely. And I mean, if you think about it, if you're maybe in your 40s, you might be used to heading out to work every day, coming home to your young family, coaching the local GAA team. So you're contending with this diagnosis, but then all these other things around you are changing. So if you're impacted by younger onset dementia, you know, people want to stay involved in the things that they've always done. And sometimes we just need to make slight adjustments to be able to support them to continue to be involved.
Yeah, and we're going to have a chat about maybe some of those supports in a moment. But can I just ask you, because I have in my own area, I have a very big interest in kind of lifestyle and chronic disease, and includes kind of links to dementia and Alzheimer's. But in terms of what we know to date, are there any risk factors for the development of dementia and Alzheimer's as we age?
Yeah, there are. There's actually the Lancet Commission, which is kind of an international report, published a lot of work around dementia prevention and intervention. And they say that there are 12 potentially modifiable risk factors, and they account for around 40% of worldwide dementias. So ways around this might be, for example, to exercise, to maintain a healthy weight, to avoid smoking and alcohol, to stay involved in your local communities, you know, socialize. And a lot of that is about, you know, healthy body, healthy mind. But one thing that I think is very interesting is hearing loss is actually potentially quite a significant risk factor. Mm. And hearing loss is something that we can often correct. So if you have a hearing loss, I really urge your listeners to go out and get their hearing checked and to make sure that they get it corrected if that's possible.
Yeah, and because I suppose with hearing loss, obviously, it can really impact how you engage with life and, you know, your own stimulation and all of the things that the rest of us take for granted. So I could imagine on so many levels that that's really important. So good to highlight that, actually.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not saying if someone's experiencing hearing loss that they're going to get dementia. It's nothing like that.
Of course,
but it is,
yeah.
There might be a potential risk factor there. And it's always good, you know, knowledge is power. So it's always good to just go and if there is a risk factor that you can change, why not do that, you know?
Sure. And a lot of the things that you've just mentioned, Laura, like they'd be fairly common with things that just keep us healthy in general and healthy functional aging. And, you know, we would know if we do the things that you've just mentioned, they can really help reduce risk of certain cancers and diabetes and cardiovascular disease and all sorts of stuff. And of course, we've been talking about these things on the Health and Fitness Show over the last few months. But I can absolutely say from my work in the nursing homes and, of course, with my own little granny and lots of things I've observed. And of course, with COVID and with the restriction of movement and the isolation and all of these things, that this has a massive impact on dementia and Alzheimer's. It absolutely does. And on the other side of things, when I was working in nursing homes doing the exercise interventions, I can see that the benefits that they bring are incredible. So I suppose I'm just going to row in there a little bit and say, again, it's just another reason for people to try and just do what you can, when you can, get up and move. And all of the things we've been talking about on the show today, it applies to many, many things, including Alzheimer's and dementia.
Absolutely. And I think we're definitely singing from the same hymn sheet on that. And we actually published a bit of research during COVID, and we found that for a lot of people, those supports were taken away. You know, they couldn't get out and socialize or go to the local day center. Their dementia actually progressed quite quickly and got worse quite quickly. So that really highlighted how important it is to stay engaged as much as you can.
Absolutely. And just a note then to all of us to I suppose, in our own lives, do what we can to, you know, reach out if we know that there are people that we love that are being socially isolated for whatever reason, just to reach out or even, you know, we're so, so busy. Everything is so busy. We never have enough time to do anything. But, you know, the 5 minutes that you might give to someone to have a chat as you're on your way, you know, to wherever it is you're rushing to, can actually make a massive difference.
Huge. Yeah, absolutely huge. You know, I think it's all on us to look out for each other, and particularly for those people who might be more vulnerable or contending with any kind of a diagnosis. You know, we need to be checking in on people. We need to be making efforts to ensure that they're okay, because they would do the same for us.
Sure, absolutely. And so, Laura, I have actually read your report, and I was interested to read about some of the community resources and groups that are out there. Can you just give us a little bit of information about those?
Yeah, absolutely. So the report and guidance document are really just about simple resources. They're about things that already exist. You know, it could be your local library, your local GAA club. How do you go and make those a little bit more open, a little bit more accessible? And those small actions really lead to significant change. So there's kind of four central themes that we look at. So it's awareness and training, looking at individual approaches, mapping and signposting community supports, and then making them accessible. And I think what's really important is if you look in the guidance document, there is a huge list of resources there that you could have a look at and go through and see what might be relevant to your service or your local group.
Yeah, so yeah, no, that's really important, just to see of what exists at the moment, how can we make it more inclusive? Instead of, you know, thinking, oh, well, I don't have time to look into that, or I don't have the resources or whatever, but what can I do now? What simple thing can I do now to make it more inclusive?
Exactly. I mean, maybe you work in the local charity shop, maybe you work in the library, and you might not have the resources to go and create something new, but it doesn't necessarily need to take a huge amount of time or money, you know.
We've been speaking with Laura O'Philbin, and Laura is the Research and Policy Manager at the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland. Just one of the things that really stood out to me in the report, and I love the idea of this, was cafes for people who are affected by these conditions. I'd imagine they're, from the social perspective and even getting out and about and getting active and doing things like that, that's a really great idea.
Oh, they're absolutely brilliant. You know, the Alzheimer cafes are so important. It's just a nice, easy space. Everyone has a cup of tea, you know, a few pastries. Usually there might be a speaker that will come in for about 20 minutes or a half an hour to talk on kind of a topic of interest. And it's just a really nice social atmosphere and experience, and people feel included and they feel supported.
And would they be for just the people who have the diagnosis, or would be for their families as well?
No, their families would be very welcome to attend, and sometimes the person with the diagnosis might not feel ready to go, and a family member might go to the first couple to see what they're like.
That's very interesting. And something like, it's amazing what you notice now. I'm going back 20 years and I know a lot of research has been done in this space since. But, you know, music, song, dance seems to be a very powerful thing and something that people are very receptive to. So I remember, like, if you can imagine, I walk into a nursing home and there's, you know, 40, potentially 40 people in the room. So I walk in with my bag of exercise tricks and, you know, people have all sorts of conditions. Now, not everybody has dementia, of course, but you have so many different people from so many different walks of life and so many conditions going on. And here am I going to do an exercise session. And so I start and I put on music and I put on, you know, an age appropriate music. And back then, of course, I was bringing CDs and my little, you know, stereo in and stuff. And the minute I put on the music, somebody would get up off their chair, particularly someone who had Alzheimer's or dementia. They would come straight over to me. Didn't matter to them who I was. Didn't. All they wanted was a dance partner. And so the minute the music started, they just start dancing and smiling and you know, having a great time. Now, here am I as an instructor trying to dance with somebody and instruct the exercise class for everybody. It was absolutely total chaos. It was absolutely brilliant. It was really fun and it made such a difference. And it's little things like this can make such a difference. And even at my young age back then, I just remember thinking, wow, you know, the power of this is incredible.
Oh, completely. And I worked with a gentleman before, and the highlight of his week was when he went to the local dog shelter and he would walk the dogs, you know, and that was part of his voluntary work that he did in the community. But it was so important to him, you know.
But absolutely, and of course the energy and everything that you get back from this little being that you're looking after, and sure, all they want is to be walked and they're happy, and you get that back as well. So, you know, I think it's just a key message here is that it can be the little things that can actually make a massive difference.
Absolutely, and it's just those small actions, you know, they really add up. And you know, maybe it's not about an Alzheimer cafe for one person. Maybe, you know, they just want to go to their regular cafe and that's fine. But if the staff have watched a couple of videos or done a little bit of training about dementia, think about the difference that could make to that person and their family, you know?
Sure. And absolutely. That brings me on to my next question is what. So I was going to ask you, what do you want to achieve with this report? But of course, that's one of the answers.
Yeah, absolutely. Just open up our communities a bit more to people with younger onset dementia. I think in Ireland we're so lucky. Like, we have incredible communities. That's a real strength in Ireland. And I think it's really important to be able to equip our communities with information, because I feel like everyone wants to be inclusive and sometimes you just don't know how. So to provide this information is just basically to give people, you know, a tool to open themselves up a bit more.
Yeah, and for people who want to access this report or even get in contact, where do they go from here?
Yeah, so it's available on our website, which is www.alzheimer.ie, and you can read it there. There's a big kind of long research report, but there's also a very accessible guidance document, which is a great place to start. So that would be where I'd recommend to read it. And if you have any questions, you can always get in touch at research@alzheimer.ie.
Brilliant. And lastly, speaking of research, Laura, it's so important in this area and in all areas. And often people want to get involved and see what's happening. You know, if they're being affected by these conditions, they often want to see kind of what's out there, what's going on at the moment, and maybe they want to get involved. And have you any way that they can do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I'm very biased because I'm the research manager, but we have a service called Team Up for Dementia Research, which is basically about breaking down barriers between researchers and, you know, the public, people affected by dementia and their families, because people kind of want to know what's happening in research, but they don't know how to go about finding it. So with this service, you just sign up through us, the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland. It's really straightforward. And basically, we're just able to tell people then what research is happening, if there's any opportunities to participate in a research study, and it means that we can do it in a safe way that puts people affected by dementia first. So they're not going to be, you know, receiving hundreds of emails and no one's going to be contacting them unexpectedly. It'll always come through ourselves, the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland.
Fantastic. Laura, I just want to wish you all the best in everything that you're doing. I think the work that you're doing is fantastic. I think it's just so invaluable for the people who have been affected by dementia and Alzheimer's and their families and friends and everyone who loves them. And I hope that by doing things like this on the show, that it starts to kind of get people thinking about and talking about the little things that we can do to help. So I want to thank you so much for your time, Laura, and just wish you all the best with everything else in the future.
No, thank you, Diane. Thanks so much for having me on. It's been a really great chat. And just if any of your listeners out there are concerned about their memory or they do have any questions they want to ask related to dementia, we have a fantastic helpline and it's 1-800-341-341. Okay, thanks for having me on.
Excellent. Thanks, Laura.
Bye now.
So would you like to stay in bed for 60 days and get paid for it? I know that might sound a little strange, but this is actually what Dr. Ciara Ward, sports scientist, exercise physiologist and health researcher with EduFit, is going to talk to us about today. And just in case you think, what has that actually got to do with me? She's going to actually tell us all about the changes that happened for the people that she worked with and actually how it applies to all of us and why we need to do something about this. Okay, so Ciara, thanks very much for joining me in studio today. You're very welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Diane.
Now, I should say, so Ciara, We've known each other a while. So when I originally started lecturing, Ciara was in my first sports science class. And so she first became an amazing sports scientist. And then she decided, in her wisdom, to do a PhD with me. And we, as she's going to tell you now, we were funded by the European Space Agency to work on this particular project. Ciara, can you tell, so what have you been up to in your PhD?
Yeah, so myself and Diane have had a great 10 years together. Would you believe? We can't believe it either. So I've just recently finished my PhD and it was in the Technological University of the Shannon. And my PhD was actually funded by the European Space Agency PRODEX programme and Enterprise Ireland. And the scientific title now was The Effect of 60 Days, 6 Degree, Head Down Tilt Bed Rest on the Metabolic Physiology of Young Healthy Males. So
yeah, that's the fancy title on your thesis, right? So what does that mean in real life?
That's the fancy title. So what that means is that we actually looked at the physical health and the metabolic health of young, healthy, normal weight males before and after 60 days of 6 degree head down tilt bed rest.
Now, Ciara, we might just tell people why are people put into 60 days bed rest?
Yeah, so the overall study was actually funded by the European Space Agency and hosted at the German Aerospace Centre in Cologne, which is also known as the DLR. And the overall aim of the space agencies is to see how they can make or keep their astronauts as healthy as possible for as long as possible in space. And one method for this, because spaceflight is so hard to conduct research in, they use these ground-based analog models, and one of those is head down tilt bed rest. So they put their subjects into this head down tilt bed rest. So their head is slightly lower than their feet, which is a degree of 6 degrees. And it's like if you were on the couch and you leant down and put your head backwards to grab something, that feeling of the rush of blood to your head, or if you've ever hung on monkey bars upside down, it's like the same feeling that the head down tilt bed rest subjects get for the first few hours, and the astronauts get when they arrive in space as well. So that is the reason for the 6 degree head down tilt. And then ourselves as exercise physiologists, we can look at what happens to the human body when we expose it to extreme physical activity and sedentary behaviour.
Exactly. So what we're basically saying is this extreme physical inactivity and sedentary behaviour effectively is what happens to astronauts in space. So
yes,
if we can figure out what's happening to people on Earth and ideally come up with effective countermeasures for that, then we could apply it in some way to astronauts in space, and we can keep them healthier for longer, and therefore they can do greater exploration and so on and so on.
Yeah,
so that's the link. Okay, so now, how many young healthy males went into bed rest?
Yeah, so the German Aerospace Centre recruited 23 healthy young male volunteers for the bed rest study. So they advertised it first via the TV and social media. So you may have seen, I think, a few newspaper articles put up, as you said, Diane, would you get paid to stay in bed for 60 days? And that, I'm sure, got a lot of interest. So they recruited them, and then the volunteers then were invited for different interviews, medical exams that had strict exclusion criteria, such as the presence of chronic diseases, and then also it finished with a DEXA scan. So they looked at their bone mineral density and content as well. So once that was in, they had 23 subjects then, and they spent a total of 90 days at the NVHAB facility at the German Aerospace Centre. So
And we should, so just when you mentioned the Space Centre, because of course we went over for the pre and post testing, it is something quite phenomenal, isn't it, when you walk in?
Yeah, like yeah. It's like you can see the top of it overground, but the building is actually underground.
Mm.
And it's like they don't see sunlight.
Mm.
They can, like, there's little, you know, deviations in the building that come down and you can see it, but like they don't even see the outside, and there's all these corridors that are painted green, and it's like a mini hospital in a way, isn't it?
It really is. And then of course what people would have seen on TV would be the centrifuge machines, you know, because
yeah,
some of the previous studies would have had, like, for example, bicycles attached to the centrifuge, and as it's spinning people are trying to and there's all sorts of crazy things happening.
Yeah.
And you can change the altitude in the rooms, you can change you know, temperature, lighting, you can change everything, you can do simulated underwater experiments, all these great things. So it's really, from a scientific perspective, of course, like it's great, like it's brilliant to walk into it. But anyway, back to your gentlemen, and of course we met them and they're lovely.
Yeah, really, really nice.
Really, really lovely people. And so grateful for them to give their time and bodies and everything to
science.
It's fabulous. But yeah, so these guys, so they're put into bed, and, you know, I think one of the questions we get asked a lot is, but like, what do you mean? Do you mean, are they staying in bed all day? Like, can they move? Can they do anything? So will you just give our listeners a little feel for what happens during their day?
Yeah, so when they arrive, first of all, I just mentioned the first 15 days just to give an insight. So when they arrive at the bed rest study, they're actually ambulatory, which means they can walk around, but they do very, very minimal physical activity. So they're walking around, they're completing all this testing, which we'll speak about in a few minutes. And then the minute of the first day of head down tilt bed rest at 9 a.m, they go into bed. They're reduced to the minus 6 degree angle, and then they are literally in bed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, until they reach the 60 days. So it is literally all daily, leisure, essential, all activities in that position.
Bed, yeah.
Yeah. And so always one shoulder in contact with the bed at all times is the major.
That is the key. So they can't actually sit up. They're not allowed to sit up.
No.
They're encouraged not to do too many voluntary muscular contractions.
Yep.
And yeah, so then, you know, There's obvious questions then for, how do they shower? How do they eat? How do they do the things that you need to do in your day?
Yeah, absolutely. And they are the questions we went into the facility going, how do they do it? Like, we were like, seriously? So they have purposely built beds for the showers that they're, they're transferred to, again, with the one shoulder across. So they have to learn to pull themselves across to the other beds as such, and then they will eat. There's photos that we can share on social media where they're they're on their elbows and they're trying to cut with the knife and fork and an omelette, and it's crazy. And then they're watching telly and their TV screens basically upside down because they're in bed, and it's amazing to see and how they actually can manage at that angle for so long. But the staff are great. They'll keep, they keep everybody going and everybody in good form. So no, they all really enjoyed it.
And we should say, these are very, very heavily monitored study. So there's the DLR would have their own medical team on site 24/7. And then, of course, all of the different European researchers, of which we were delighted to be part of, come in and do their experiments and so on. But everything, someone said to me recently, yeah, but how do you know that they didn't sit up? Just for example, in the shower, I thought it was very interesting to find out that there is a camera, but you're only visible if you actually lift your head above a certain line.
Yeah.
So that's, there are obviously, privacy is very, very important.
Of course.
But there are certain controls put in place that you can basically make sure that nobody is cheating. So they're very, very, very heavily monitored. And by that, we also mean everything that goes in gets measured. Everything that goes out gets measured. And, they do, in terms of measurements, they've up to 90 experiments?
Up to 90 different experiments from, I think it's 12 research teams in total. And that could be anything from sleep, brain function, eye examinations. There was some psychological questionnaires. The range of tests was unbelievable. It looked at the whole human physiology of these bed rest subjects, and their schedules were crazy. We don't know how the study lead sorted the schedules because, from the time they ate to the time that they went for a shower to the time that the exercise group exercised to when questionnaires were given, everything was
tightly controlled. And we should say, just for people who mightn't be aware of the research process, all of this goes through an ethics board, and it's all approved in terms of how many experiments you can do, how much tissue you can take, how much blood you can take, how you do everything. Everything is monitored and controlled to such a strict degree. But I'll just say that because, I think sometimes when you're looking at these massive European studies, and they can cost in the region of 3.5+ million to run, it's just important to say that, it's very well regulated in terms of the participants' perspective and a safety perspective.
Yeah,
as is all research, of course. We've been speaking with Dr. Ciara Ward about her bed rest studies, and she's been telling us all about how people get recruited and how they get started. But now, you just before the break here, we were talking about measurements. Now, we did say, of course, that there are a lot of European research teams and they're up to 90 experiments. But specifically, what were you actually looking at for your involvement in this bed rest study?
Yeah, so as in every ESA bed rest study, there is basic core data collected. So what I mean by basic core data is measurements of body weight, body composition, aerobic fitness, muscle strength. So, and when I mean by body composition as well, that includes our muscle mass, our fat mass, our bone mineral content. So we had access to all of those measurements, which were so, so important, because we were actually looking at metabolic health. So we conducted an oral glucose tolerance test, and that's a worldwide standardised test for measuring glucose tolerance. So how well your body can actually metabolize glucose.
And just for anyone listening, people who are pregnant would often have those in the hospital if there was a risk of gestational diabetes. And of course, people who have diabetes, this would be, or if they're testing for diabetes, this would be one of the tests that we would actually do regularly here in Ireland in the Irish hospitals, just to mention.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So just for anyone who doesn't know, what it involves is we take a fasting blood sample, and then we give the subjects a glucose drink, and then we take blood samples every 30 minutes then for 2 hours, and we measure how well the body can tolerate.
Yeah. So you did the glucose test. Now, we did do muscle biopsies as well, which is an interesting one, of course. And for our squeamish listeners, would just maybe hold on, put your hands over your ears for 10 seconds. Basically, what it is our lovely participants are lying in bed and we take a sample of muscle from the vastus lateralis, which is basically the outside of the thigh. Now, we do this routinely in sports science. It's how we figure out what happens to muscle in response to training or detraining or different nutrition interventions. But in this case, it's really, really interesting because of the deconditioning and the muscle wastage that happens in response to bed rest. I suppose we could go on and on and on about the test, but what I'd really like to talk about, because this is what is really relevant to all of us, what happens overall in bed rest to the person's physical health and metabolic health with this kind of extreme physical inactivity?
Yeah, so the physiological adaptations that we see after head down tilt bed rest as a model of extreme physical inactivity and high levels of sedentary time is muscle atrophy, so the loss of muscle mass. We see
it can be quite significant over just a few months.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the control group lost approximately 4 kg of muscle mass overall,
muscle.
Whole body. Yeah. So, and then with that, then we see a reduction in muscle strength.
Yeah.
And we look specifically at the lower body. We also see a reduction in aerobic fitness, and we also see bone loss. And obviously these have a massive impact on functional capacity. And then in terms of metabolic dysregulation, we see an increase in insulin resistance. So the inability of our tissues to react to the action of insulin.
So obviously, we were very interested in this from a bed rest perspective, but I'm going to move away from bed rest for a minute and come back to all of us here on Earth in our daily lives. Right? And this is very interesting because, you know, I know most of us are not going to do that, but there are situations in daily life that are in this bracket.
Yeah, absolutely. So we describe this as conditions of gravity deprivation. So we have space flight, which is our astronauts going to space, and the purpose of the European Space Agency looking at these studies because they are exposed to microgravity. But on Earth, we have those that are exposed to high levels of sedentary time, physical inactivity, or those that are immobilized due to injury, illness, and a lot in the last few years due to COVID-19. And they are situations of reduced use of gravity. So you're not up walking and actually using gravity there. And then also we have the limited mobility of aging. So that's the reduced use of gravity over decades as a function of age. And the massive implications of the general population is the physiological adaptations we see in bed rest happen at a slower rate, yes, but what we see in those conditions on Earth. So, you know, you see that loss of muscle mass, you see that loss of bone loss, you see reduced functionality, you see, you know, decreases in metabolic health. And that's a massive, massive impact on chronic diseases.
Exactly. So, you know, for example, if somebody is in a hospital bed for a long time, they're going to get some of these changes, particularly if they're older adults.
Yeah.
And, you know, anyone who's ever broken an arm or a leg or had to put some type of a limb in a cast will know when the cast comes off, their leg has shrunk, basically, in volume. And that's huge muscle loss. And they'll know that there's weakness in the tissue and they need to work it to regain it and so on. So there's lots of practical examples that people will understand. But something that we have to think of actually as researchers and in our jobs, because we're quite sedentary and we sit all day, is that we get, of course, not the same response, but it's extreme sedentary behaviour. So if you don't use your muscles and if you don't move your body, you get problems. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. If you don't use it, you lose it, is what we say often. And just in case anyone doesn't know what we mean by sedentary behaviour, it's any living behaviour that's characterised by low energy expenditure when in a sitting, reclining or lying position. So examples in daily life would be like commuting or sitting at the office all day, sitting at work and things like that. And people can...
If you drive for a living.
Yeah. If you drive for a living, absolutely. And you can amount to 9-10 hours a day. And that has a huge impact on physiological health.
On health, it absolutely does. And just when you mentioned metabolism, because in fairness, this wouldn't be mainstream knowledge, but like one of the things that we look at, and of course you did in this bed rest study, is with this sedentary time, what impact does it have on all of the organs and tissues in our body that keep us healthy? So, for example, you know, if you take the liver, take the kidneys, take your pancreas, take your lovely muscles, take all of these organs and tissues that they have the potential to either keep us healthy or unfortunately, the opposite situation. And what we can see now in the last definitely 20-30 years in the scientific community is that we're starting to study the biomarkers or the hormones that are being produced in all of these tissues. And it's obviously it's an emerging field and we learn new things every day. But what we can see from sedentary behaviour is that how those tissues behave is very much a factor of what you do to yourself or what you expose yourself to. So if you sit a lot all day, if you're not very active, if you eat things that maybe aren't health enhancing and so on and so on and so on, it triggers signals to get these organs and tissues and they basically produce hormones that can contribute to ill health. But if you do the opposite and you move and you do all these things, of course, it sends a different signal and they produce different hormones that keep us healthy. So now here am I obviously just saying that because I've worked in the field for a long time. But did you see this in the bed rest study as well? Did you see the changes in hormones in response to people lying for excessively long periods of time?
Yeah. So one of the big things that I just want to mention about the bed rest study is we actually maintain the subjects in energy balance. And what this means is that we keep the balance literally between energy intake. So if you take energy intake on your left hand side and your energy expenditure on your right hand side, we kept that in balance so that a decrease in energy expenditure didn't actually increase fat mass.
So basically you're keeping fat constant.
Constant. Because in daily life, if we reduced our physical activity and we're more sedentary, but we didn't decrease our energy intake, so our food, this would lead to an increase in fat mass and cause, you know, worse metabolic changes. Of the hormones that we measured, even despite keeping fat mass constant, we did see changes in our hormones, which indicate that specifically the liver and the muscle weren't working as well after bed rest than before bed rest. And these were healthy males. So if you
were, you know, they were fit, you know, they were lean. And all we did was make them very inactive.
Exactly. So like if you think of someone who didn't have a good baseline level of fitness or didn't have, you know, like good metabolic health, that would obviously have worse ramifications then for them if they went under like that extreme physical inactivity and sedentary behaviour.
Absolutely. Now, Ciara, I would love to keep talking about the study and I'd love to keep talking about everything that happened, but I'm going to run out of time. So what I want to do is, I think we are at a point now where we're saying, look, physical inactivity is a problem, and it is.
Yes.
And, you know, I would always say like very low levels of fitness and functional capacity is a clinical condition.
Yes.
Because it causes so many problems. And in fact, you know, in previous weeks, we've been talking about people, you know, we've been talking about aging and older adults and so on. And one of the things that's interesting is usually you talk about an older adult as someone who's over 65. But now there are a certain category of people from the age of 50 who are actually classified as older adults because they have clinical conditions and their body is behaving as if it's that much older.
Yep.
So really what I'm coming back around to is activity of any description. I don't care what it is. Move your body. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. Any physical activity is so important, but more is always better.
Yeah.
So as much as you can, whether you're building up from 5 minutes to 10 minutes to 15 minutes. You know, you don't have to go out for these 2 hours. Like,
no,
you keep
no.
adding mm. up and mm. that will have a massive, massive impact on your health.
Just move. Yeah. So just to leave us, Ciara, have you any top tips for us in terms of trying to get a little bit more physical activity into our days?
Yeah, so I would always recommend a quick 3-step process. So the first step would be document your day. So what I mean by this is take a look at your daily habits. So for example, take a working day and take a weekend day and have a look at what you usually do. So as an example, if I get up at 7, I have then I get ready for 45 minutes. I have a 45 minute commute. I might sit at work all day for approximately 8 hours. I then have another commute home, 45 minutes. And then I have a few hours in the evening where you may or you may not be physically active. And then obviously it depends what time you go to bed. So by looking at that day already, you can see that they've already been sedentary for at least 9 hours. And if you don't get your physical activity in the end, you're also physically inactive and highly sedentary, which is the highest risk for chronic disease development. So first thing is working out how much time you're physically inactive and you're sedentary. And then after that, it's identifying opportunities for activity. So that's step two. So could you increase your physical activity in the morning, in the afternoon or in the evening? And we do understand that the evening is not everybody's personal time because of other commitments, for children, for caring for someone, things like that. So if it's not the evening time, could it be the morning or could it be the afternoon? And step three then is to plan some activities. So for example, if your time is the morning, you know, could you get up 15 minutes early and do a 15 minute exercise routine? Could you do a 5 minute breathing routine before you leave? Or could you actually leave 20 minutes early and get a 15 minute walk in before you go into work? And then if it's lunchtime, you know, we recommend things like walk and talk. So
yeah,
you know,
even during the working day, because I will say, because honestly I sit a lot as part of my day, I walk when I have meetings, if it's on the phone or whatever it is, or even little things. And I don't know if people realise how important these are, like using the stairs instead of lifts.
Yes.
Parking a little bit further away from wherever it is you're going. If you add up all of these little things that you do, so you've never, you haven't gone to the gym, you haven't, you know, taken up a new sport, you haven't done any of these things, but yeah, it doesn't matter. Okay, loads of benefits with that, that's a conversation for another day, but it's all of the little things in terms of reducing the amount of times that you're sedentary.
Yeah.
Do those things that could take 30 seconds at a time, you know, little bites throughout the day, massive impact for health.
Oh, massive, massive impact. And like that in an evening time then, if you're watching your favourite programme and it's got 2 ad breaks, in the ad breaks, get up and move around, go, you know, and like you said, Diane, go into the bathroom, use the upstairs bathroom if you have one instead of the downstairs bathroom. And every time you get up from, you know, you're doing a sit to stand and then you're doing a stand to sit, like that's all functional movements that are so, so important without going for, you know, a massive run or like that. Or like, and a massive thing as well is, you know, in an evening time, meet a friend for a walk instead of going for a cup of tea. Let's go for a walk and make both yourselves accountable for going for
carry
that
walk. Carry your tea. Walk slowly. Yeah. Walk, you know, chat, have your cup of tea and move slowly. So I think, Ciara, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us today. And I think the key message here is just move whenever you can in whatever way you can.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Diane.
Thanks, Ciara. We are joined again in studio by our lovely Ruth, registered associate nutritionist with EduFit. So Ruth, what is your tip and recipe of the week for this week?
So because yesterday was International Day of Awareness of Food Loss and Waste, this week I'm going to share some tips with you on how you can reduce food waste.
Brilliant.
So 2 years ago, the Environmental Protection Agency in Ireland did some research and they found that the main reasons for waste are food passing its use-by date and forgetting to eat leftovers on time. So oftentimes there can be confusion over the difference between the use-by date and the best-before date. The use-by date is used for food safety. So this is a deadline. We shouldn't consume food after this date. However, the best-before date is an indicator of food quality. So it can be used as a guideline rather than a deadline. So if something, now of course use your own judgment, if there's mould on it or starts to smell a bit funny, don't eat it, obviously. Whereas with the use-by date, absolutely do not consume after. Even if it looks fine, this has been calculated from scientific testing. Keep away from it.
That's really, really important, because I've often used things after the best before date and they're fine.
Absolutely. And that's the key. They're absolutely fine. It's the best before date is OK. It's the use by date where it's not fine.
OK, perfect. And what about your recipe of the week for this week, Ruth?
So my recipe this week is homemade vegetable soup. And this is really great to use leftover vegetables in, or vegetables that are starting to wilt. And my secret ingredient here to give it that really nice flavour that you may get in hotels and restaurants that maybe you're lacking at home is bouquet garni. So I'll show you what that is on.
Interesting. Yeah. I thought it was cream. Go ahead.
No, it's really nice. It's basically just like a tea bag of different herbs, and it's really, really nice. It gives you that flavour that sometimes can be missing from homemade soup. So keep an eye on the Midlands 103 social media for that.
I love it. I'll definitely be doing that. Ruth, thanks a million.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining me over the last hour, and a special thank you to all of our guests. If you missed any part of the show, or indeed previous shows, you can always listen back on midlands103.com or wherever you get your podcasts from. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. So if you have a question, or you'd like to suggest a topic, or indeed join me on the show, please email me at healthandfitness@midlands103.com. Country Roads is on the way after the news, and I'll chat to you again next Friday from 7 p.m.